Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome to Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today's program is devoted to disaster relief and how we can do it better. My guest in studio today is Christy Robb. She is the Director of Food Services for the excellent St. John's Bread and Life, an emergency food provider in Brooklyn. She has a long history in case management and social services, and prior to that, she was a punk rocker. Welcome, Christy.
Hi.
I hear my phone. Searching for
before. Oh, I didn't turn my phone off either.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we got to do that. So, anyway, never mind. So, Christy, talk to us about your day-to-day job, because St. John's Bread and Life provides something like 2,300 or 2,500 meals per day to your community in Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Yeah, we do a soup kitchen, a mobile soup kitchen, and a food pantry. We got two meals a day that go out. So, yeah, it's about 2,500 meals a day that we're normally doing Monday through Friday.
It's not a huge space either, by the way. I worked in it last week with you, and it's not like you have, 18 burners, a giant flat top. You know, it's kind of limited in its resources, and even the counter space is not enormous. You do have a lot of sinks, which is good, and a dishwashing station.
Somebody wanted a lot of sinks in there.
Yeah.
I know that.
Yeah.
That struck me as interesting too.
But you have a big soup kettle. You have like one of those brazier things, but and some convection ovens. It's pretty modest considering your output.
Yeah.
And you have the mobile soup kitchens. So what happens when you do that? When you supply those,
they go out with usually about 300 meals mm-hmm. in the morning, in the afternoon, to about five or six different sites around the city. So they go to Queens. They go out to Coney Island on a normal basis. They're in East New York and Williamsburg, and they provide meals out there for usually a couple hours in the morning, a couple hours in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
And it's the same meal that we're serving at St. John's, so we cook it out of that same kitchen.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it would have to be at that kind of volume. I mean, just to digress for a second, I mean, I was like, when I came into work with you last week, and I'm coming from my catering background where we're talking like 300, 400, 500 people, and it's like, I just had no, you know, my persnickety way of cooking just doesn't work for that volume level.
But some of it does, and that's what I'm trying to figure out too, because I come more from that size, although way back I've done a lot bigger, but it was all homemade at that point. I mean, there wasn't even the processed food available.
Right.
But yeah, it's a little bit tricky, but some of it does translate. It's just, you got to figure it out, which is what I'm in the process of doing, which is what you were helping me do. How can we do really good cooking in that type of volume?
And in that volume, yeah. And also dealing with just the sheer volume of vegetables. I mean, you get a lot of donations from the food bank and from other places. In fact, I was, you know, having done some culinary demonstrations there, I've been absolutely stunned by the quality of produce that comes in from your green market suppliers, which, you know, obviously goes away in the winter, but still. And just, you know, making sure that the stuff doesn't go bad and that, you get to use it all up before it's past its prime and so on. That's got to be a big challenge.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm getting better and better at it, but yeah.
So now, in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to call it Superstorm Sandy. I know that's the cool thing to do, and I guess it was in my reading today. I discovered that it is absolutely the first and only time we've ever had a storm of this magnitude, 1,000 miles in diameter, and that was the confluence of a regular hurricane, which is a summer storm, meeting a winter storm. That has never happened before in the history of weather predictions or weather, you know, charting. So, you know, it's clearly a response to the change in climate. Now, when when your staff and you and Tony Butler and the other guys who work there were confronted with the storm relief, what were the decisions you had to make, and how is coping with, you know, that extra volume of meals? I mean, how do you manage that?
Well, you know, it kind of rolls out, sorry for the bad pun, rolls out in a, you know, every day, right? So we were open the first 2 days of the day the storm hit, and the next day people came in for an abbreviated period and put out breakfast and lunch, which amazing. Is sort of amazing. I did not get there because I live in the West Village, so I was really not, I was scared to come on Monday of the first day, and then I didn't make it there on Tuesday. But then we were open the rest of the week, and each day we just kind of did something more, and we kind of figured out something more we should do. Mm-hmm. So we went out to our regular site in Coney on Thursday, which is the day we go out there, and then we just went there Friday as well. And then by Monday, we were like, we've got to basically put a huge amount of our effort towards disaster relief. And so, you know, and Tony and I kind of came together in the morning at 8 o'clock on Monday morning and said, we got to do this. And then the next thing we know, Robin Hood called, and they want us to try to do it, and they're helping us do it. And then it just went from there. And then every day we ended up going out. So we went out to the Rockaways a few days. We went out to Coney every day last week. And we just, you know, started doing it. And we just kind of, you know, doing it by the seat of our pants and do it, roping in as many people as we could. Most of our staff stayed extra.
Yeah.
We were working, 12, 15-hour days. We were in there all last weekend, both Saturday and Sunday, because we had to be. I mean, that's just the only way to get it done.
Sure.
So, you know, that's what we did. And we just kept trying to put out as much stuff as we could. The city of New York, through a program actually at HRA called EFAP, ended up delivering to us 18 pallets of food. Called us right away, said, what do you need? We said, we need pantry food, because we heard that people actually out in the areas that were the most affected needed pantry food. I mean, not complicated pantry food, not rice and pasta, but things like tuna fish and peanut butter and stuff that they could just use easily, bread. So with the food, with the hot meals, because we always brought out a hot meal, because we knew that that was really crucial, especially last week when it was so cold.
Yeah.
And we just kept making soups.
But then you were also bringing out bags of groceries. Things that people could sustain themselves with during
the
times when you're not
there. Shelf-stable milk and juice and just stuff that we knew would be useful. Because we're dealing with people that are in those circumstances actually all the time. So that part of it was sort of not as hard for us, because we're doing it already. And it was just sort of extrapolating it out to a bigger situation and people that would not normally necessarily be our clients.
Right. Fascinating. I mean, absolutely incredible. So let's move on to you and I had such an interesting conversation yesterday and today prior to the show. It's like hard to know even where to start.
Too bad that wasn't taped.
Yeah.
Just us talking while we're having some Bloody Marys.
I know, we're so cool. But how do you feel like the disaster relief has actually worked in the moment? Because, I mean, a lot of the things that we talked about, some things have been planned for, like there was obviously a plan for Con Ed. There was a plan for the subway system. I mean, it took a lot of hard work, obviously, but that stuff has been working, although Con Ed. Mm. But I loved Andrew Cuomo saying, do it right and do it now or lose your contract. I thought that was really kick-ass of him.
And probably, I really appreciated that, too. And probably the workers, I mean, you know, it's always hard to separate the workers from the management. I mean, I feel like the workers have been out there. And they obviously were out there because they got a lot of stuff up and running right away. It was freezing cold. It was horrible conditions. Some of them might have been affected, too. We don't even know. You know, so that's hard for me to work out, because I want to feel like they've actually busted their asses too to get the city back up and running, and they must have. I mean, those are individual human beings at the end of the day who had to do that work.
Well, it was,
and
every
as we know,
building.
Some of them were kicked out for the marathoners at one point of their hotel rooms near the disaster site so they could work. But that's another story. We didn't even get into that.
I know, right?
I think the city has gotten much better at pre-disaster planning, so they know when to shut down the subways. They know when to tell people,
to evacuate.
Schools will be closed. Right. Evacuate your homes. This is real. Even if it's not, we have to plan for it to be real. And they would have taken tons of shit if they hadn't done that. So, I mean, they have to do that. We're allowed to curse on here, right? Because it's internet.
Yeah. I mean, I don't encourage it, but go right ahead. I mean, I do it. It's okay. It's okay.
But I think clearly there's a lot of post-disaster that, okay, once it hits as big as we thought, are we really prepared? And obviously there's a lot of problems that we weren't thinking about or we, you know, weren't in place, like fuel. You know?
Well, fuel was one. Just the sheer magnitude of the power outage.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody had anticipated that. I don't think they anticipated that basements and building infrastructure would be as damaged as they have been. I mean, I was reading a lot about the Knickerbocker Village on the Lower East Side, which is home to a lot of elderly people and has been a real thorn in the side of the Manhattan, you know, piece of the puzzle, just because, like, out in the Rockaways, like in Coney Island, there are these pockets of sort of housing development, low-income or middle-income housing, where, you know, the residents cannot get in and out of the building or up and down the stairs because they're too old and it's too dark.
Yeah.
And what has that meant? And to realize that the infrastructure of those buildings is very old, that even if they can dry it out, it's not necessarily going to be so easy to fix it. And that's been a lot of the stuff that has slowed down relief and aid to those buildings. I see a lot of complaints in the media, or not a lot, but some, about FEMA and Red Cross. Can you talk a little bit about how, you know, what their piece of it is and how they operate and why it's not more obvious that they're around and doing their thing?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one, and my take on it, and this is without knowing 100%, but I do have somebody that I've talked to that does volunteer with them and has given me some insight into it, and I think part of it is that they're a really big machine, and they can respond to a tsunami in Indonesia, right, at some point, and clearly community groups are not capable of that. Because they have this huge network, but it takes a lot of time for them to get that network in place. And I think that's the same problem that FEMA has. Mm-hmm. They're also a big machine, and while they can be very efficient once they get in place, they takes them a lot of time, and there's a lot of holes in the meantime. And community groups end up filling that in. And so I think, and then even when they get in place, it's limited. They can't necessarily get to every single place. And so that's good or bad. I'm not really weighing in on an opinion because I think it's a complicated issue.
Yeah.
And clearly
thank God,
it could be better.
I really hate the black and white. It's like...
Yeah, I think it's not that simple.
It's really not.
You know, how does a society respond to stuff like this? And then there's, of course, all the other problems where people purposely don't respond in the right way or have judgments or racism is at play, like in Katrina. So that's another level of it. But I think just from the baseline, it's not that simple an issue, and it's quite complex. And I think we need to spend a lot more time in between these things, really working on them and really putting a lot of heads on them, and a lot of different people need to be at the table, not just the people in government, not just the people that have the power or the resources, literal power, but all the different players that are part of it, which is pretty much everybody down to the dogs and cats.
Yeah.
Well, so we're all part of it.
It's been really interesting how well community groups have responded and how involved community groups have been in addressing some of these holes, as you describe. I mean, yesterday when I was doing some research for the program, I watched a sort of home video of a woman out in, I think it was Brighton Beach or Coney Island, and she, you know, speaking of one of these big housing developments for middle-income, you know, or fixed-income residents, and a lot of elderly people, and again, a situation where they can't get in and out, and food and resources, water is not coming to them, and it's because the Red Cross is not aware, because the National Guard is not aware, because FEMA is not aware of the existence of the building or what the resident population is. And that's where that community piece really comes in, I think, because one of the things you and I were talking about, we're going to take a break in just a second, but just the idea of mapping out communities on a certain level so that those areas are pinpointed.
And it has to be updated because things change so much, especially right now in New York City. This is not necessarily true of every city, although it probably is now. But they're just changing dramatically, right? Buildings are getting ripped down left, right, and center. New, big, fancy office towers and buildings are being put there. So even just knowing what's current, you know, there's probably buildings that are on the roster that don't exist anymore and buildings that do or not. So I'm sure that's going on because it's just so much stuff. So,
well, I think we should just make a list, Christy, and we'll just submit it to the mayor's and the government governor's office.
A good old laundry list works really well.
Yeah, it really does. Joe, we should take a quick commercial drop here, and we'll be right back with Christy Robb, the Director of Food Services for St. John's Bread and Life in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. Thanks so much.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
You're listening to Leaving by Dead Stars on heritageradionetwork.org.
We're back. This is Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're talking about disaster relief today with Christy Robb, the Director of Food Services for St. John's Bread and Life, a food provider, a food pantry, a mobile soup kitchen for the communities in Bed-Stuy, but also in other communities like Coney Island and elsewhere around New York City. Christy, thanks again for joining me today. So there is just so much to cover here. So in the future, we were talking earlier before the show, like some of the unexpected problems that came up, for instance, the gas availability, the fact that the refineries in Elizabeth were shut down from the flooding and that it's been very hard to get gas into the city, transportation for volunteers to disaster sites. Why should people be, you know, using their own gas? I mean, why isn't the city giving city buses to, you know, rotate people in and out of the Coney Island area or over to Staten Island, whatever? Clean water. Who thought of that? There should be water trucks available, mobilized right away. The street lights, the fact that those Klieg lights didn't go up. I mean, we could go on and on. Why don't you talk a little bit about some of the things that you thought, you know, certainly from your history, because we can work in that Great Peace March thing here now.
And all the other mobile stuff I've done over the years.
Yeah, you've done a lot of that. So let's talk a little bit about how the city could be better prepared.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mentioned too how I saw the Freedom Tower lit up on, I think it was probably Wednesday or Thursday. So my neighborhood was still completely pitch black and evacuated or decimated, you know, deserted. And I'm hearing about all the people out in all the areas that were the most affected as well, having no light, any light. And I'm seeing this gigantic building with, you know, probably, I don't know how many Klieg lights they had in that building. I'd love to know. That'd be a great sort of fact. Ridiculous. Why that building didn't need to be lit up, and those lights could have been in other places, and they could have that stuff on the ready. We talked about with the Peace Walk how we had, you know, a big water truck. It was just on a little trailer, a big like the cement, you know, the round cement things with water on it.
In Mexico, those are constantly running back and forth on the coast because they have so little fresh water there.
I mean, how hard would that be to get, you know, have 100 of those sitting someplace in a warehouse ready to go if we have neighborhoods with no clean water? I mean,
right.
So I think this stuff we could really figure out. It's not that big a deal, but we just got to do it before we're actually in the crisis, because once we're in it, then we're just in it and the train is rolling and we can't really stop it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, even like us doing all the food that we did last week, the extra food, because we were doing probably about 500 to 1,000 extra meals a day with the same staff that we always work with.
Right.
But now this week we have a much better idea of how to do it and how many people we need, and we're going to have two shifts, and you know, we're going to do some, we had time to catch our breath and make some plans. So now is the time to figure out next time. And you already hit on it. I mean, it's lights, water,
sanitation, working toilets.
You know, I had also on that walk, we had a trailer with 8 porta potties on it.
Yeah.
I mean, how many porta potties live in America? I mean,
how
hard would it be?
How many live in New York? I mean, right. We bring them out for all the festivals.
Yeah, they're out for all kinds of stuff. They're out for construction sites. I mean, how hard would it be to make sure that those get into areas that don't have flushing water? I mean, I don't think this is rocket science. It's just a matter of really identifying it, planning it, and then deciding who's going to put it in place for us right away.
Well, I think that's the challenge because, and that's sort of where that whole community group piece of it comes in. I mean, I suppose, you know, the Red Cross obviously has a lot of those supplies, but as you pointed out in the earlier segment, it takes a while for them to get mobilized and to understand exactly where those resources need to be directed. And FEMA, even though it's, and I've done quite a bit of reading about this, FEMA is largely directed by the states. It's a federal emergency management agency, but they, the state is telling FEMA where to go.
Right.
So it's not like it's, you know, some big government thing that just kind of decides what it's going to do and when it feels like doing it. So, but without that community piece, without the piece of like Occupy Sandy.
Oh my God, they did amazing, they've been amazing stuff. Yeah, in terms of centralizing information, in terms of getting people to know where to go, what to bring to, what to donate, because we were talking about how that's a huge issue. People just donating everything and anything without there really being a focus. And that site has really tried to explain to people this is what is needed.
Yeah.
And new stuff. It's got to be new batteries. You can't be taking batteries out of your flashlight and donating. It doesn't help people.
Right.
So it's all that kind of stuff being centralized and really people understanding what it is that's needed
and where they can send it or where they can bring it. I mean, one of the smartest things I saw earlier in the week right after the storm was one of my Facebook friends, Judith Newman, who's a, you know, a writer for the New York Times and many magazines. And she said, here's a great idea. You know, go to Amazon, order stuff. I ordered blankets, but I could have ordered baby supplies or batteries and flashlights, you know, whatever it is. Go to Amazon, order it and send it. And she published the name of the city councilman for the Rockaways. And his place, his office or his house or whatever it was, became the depot for these deliveries.
Right.
And then
right.
he can organize his people to get it out to this, you know, to the community at large. And I thought that was a really smart way to do it. And that's something
beautiful.
That,
it's so easy. Anybody can do it. Because people have been calling me and saying, I feel guilty. I can't get there. I can't do this. Like,
right.
And I'm like, just go online. You'll find out what you can do without leaving your chair and you won't feel guilty. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody should feel guilty. I mean, I think it's a situation where some of us are in place and able to do stuff directly and some of us are doing other things. And I was talking to Steve, who owns Gourmet Guild in Williamsburg, and we're talking about how some people just need to keep the real world going, the regular world going. People want to come back to something, so that's important too. You know, it's not
right.
And that everybody's affected just because it's happening, it's out there. Everybody has an impact on everybody, and you do what you can do. I mean, but I think we need to tighten up who is able to do the bigger stuff, the direct service piece, and create those depots in every neighborhood. So every neighborhood has a St. John's, for instance, that's willing to receive. And we are, by the way, because we're taking stuff out with the food. So we're taking out hot meals, pantry. And now yesterday, Ralph Lauren gave us probably 200 brand new comforters that will go out with us.
Right.
So, you know, we have our own limit, but we can do a lot of that. So we know that
you have the infrastructure.
Yeah. And we have the staff and we have the connection to volunteers and we have funders who have been helping us. The city of New York gave us probably 40 pallets of food because they know we're sending out pantry.
Right.
So rather than them trying to figure it all out themselves, they're coming to some of their partner organizations that they already fund. And once they identify that we're doing what we say we're doing, then, you know, the food is rolling in for us to give out.
Right,
to
process and move. Yeah, exactly.
Which was incredible, and it's all really good stuff that people need. So
one of the things that the city could do, or any city could do, not just New York, but any city, is to know who these groups are and how to connect them to each other so that they can not duplicate their own services. And maybe trade volunteers or trade neighborhoods or what, however that works. And then also the idea of like almost creating a baby registry and like even hooking up almost a QVC kind of thing.
We were talking about that.
Right.
That would be perfect.
Yeah, for like flashlights or those lamps that you stick up on the wall of your closet and
all
pull
the
this
cool
string.
Camping gear that we could have. Yeah. Which is what people really need right now. It's really just all that good camping gear. Yeah, and you could know we need 10,000 blankets and we could see it going down as people bought them.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
And then we move on to batteries or lights or
absolutely.
Or you can choose.
Or a camping stove. Or,
yeah, I mean,
yeah,
there's
whatever
so many ways we could actually do it that would be successful.
And that would be addressing some of those very basic needs like blankets, like lights. I don't know, even like 5-gallon jugs for water, you know, like that was something I didn't have last year in Irene when I didn't have power for 8 days and we ran through the bathtubs and the sinks pretty fast. And, you know, and I had no big jugs for water. I ended up and my hardware stores, because you know the transportation, distribution, that kind of stuff, and that's another whole piece of the puzzle.
Yeah,
but they weren't getting into stores. So, you know, people bought, like, there was an immediate run on generators. There was an immediate run on 5-gallon jugs for fuel or for water. It took me 4 days to get one.
Yeah, so we were talking about that, sort of a rationing system that has to go in place sort of a certain amount of days before a disaster, because it becomes crazy in that way. But here's a nod to small buildings in New York, which used to be the whole city. Is, you know, I had water in the West Village because I live on the third floor of an old tenement building.
Right.
So I had water and flushing toilets the whole disaster. Now, that could have gotten contaminated, so that would have been a different story. But
you could still flush your toilet, though, which really becomes a very, very important piece of your quality of life.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of huge, you know.
Yeah.
So that's something to remember. If you live in a small building, you don't have to be as worried, although you should put some water away just because of contamination. So I did, but I didn't need to be – it ended up being more possible for me to stay home. But then, where do we get that clean water and, you know.
Yeah, your drinking water and – yeah.
Yeah, there's all these pieces. And now is a time, like we were talking about earlier, to really start planning it.
Yeah, for the city, for the state, and for the federal government.
And for individual
government.
People.
Yeah,
you know,
and for
too.
People themselves.
I was sort of a wreck in terms of planning.
Well, after
personally.
September 11th, remember we were all encouraged to have a quote-unquote disaster kit, like know where all your important papers are in case you need to evacuate the city, or at the very least have, you know, several gallons of clean water. Like my sister-in-law... On Y2K, literally, she thought there would be no more water.
Oh, right.
So she hoarded cash and water. She literally had every closet in her apartment filled with gallon jugs of water. I mean, it was demented. And after September 11th, my ex-husband did much of the same thing. He also had peanuts, peanut butter, you know, like all those foods that don't require cooking, that are high energy, high nutrition. And that's something else that people should think about. And I mean, honestly, there were a lot of people who I think were caught short. There's some with the hoarding mentality that, you know, raided all of the supplies in Fairway. And nothing right. happened.
Right.
And then there's others who did nothing and really found themselves having a tough time afterwards.
Right.
Because it did take a while for trucks to get back into the city.
Absolutely. And I mean, somebody told me that was out with our truck yesterday in Rockaways that every store is still shut down. There's not one store open.
Because
there.
There's no power.
Yeah. And they had, and there's just so much damage. And so, you know, while stores are open in the West Village, for instance, or in parts of the Lower East Side that were shut down for a few days or even for 4 or 5 days, they're now open, but those other areas are not. So stuff isn't getting out there except for disaster relief.
That's right. So that, I mean, that's something to, and I hope in the future, I tried to get the American Trucking Association to come on this week because I wanted to talk about, like, you know, when the roads are not passable, as they were not for, you know, certainly in some of those areas, you couldn't even get through because of the power lines and the trees down and the, you know, damage to the roadbeds. And that was true certainly last summer as well, like upstate after Irene, and like entire, you know, large sections of road in Vermont and New York washed away.
Yeah.
And there was no way for trucks, which is our primary method of distribution in this country, to get product to the people who needed it or to take product away. So, you know, there's just like so many ways in which these events are going to keep happening. The 50-year flood last year was not 50 years. It was, it was like 1 in 5. And this storm and last storm and, you know, it's all going to intensify. And plus, there's always the threat of a terrorist event where you really just can't do anything except hope that you have your whatever that drug was we were supposed to take to avoid dirty bombs. What was that?
Oh, I have
a whole. I've got a bottle of that stuff.
I
do.
Good to know.
That's right. Stick with me, baby.
That's right. I'm filing away a lot of stuff like the peanuts that your ex-husband has.
Yeah.
I may need those.
Yeah, really. Anyway, unfortunately, Christy, we have to wrap this up, but I really think it would be an interesting thing to have a little series on this, on like just kind of preparedness and what it takes
Definitely.
And so forth. And thank you so much for all the good work that you are doing, that St. John's Bread and Life is doing, all of their donors.
All the people that have given us stuff to come out with, and all the staff there has been amazing.
The staff is amazing. Those people are so great. I really, really enjoyed my work there with them. And
you'll be back, hopefully.
I'll be back to teach, you know, cutting up turkeys.
That's right. We have Thanksgiving coming. I mean, it's just like we're rolling with the regular stuff, too, which is sort of fascinating.
It's a little crazy. But, you know, you seem to have your head on your shoulders, and I really really applaud you for that. So thanks to my sponsor, White Oak Pastures. Thank you to my engineer, Joe Galarraga. I'll be back next week. I'm going to be talking about garbage recycling next week and composting. Unfortunately, I forgot to write down the name of the company. I can't remember who it is. But it should be a really interesting little piece of sort of the whole issue around urban agriculture and trying to make, you know, the city more self-sustainable. And this is just part of it. You know, you don't like to think about garbage and where it goes and, you know, it like gets taken away in a truck, thank God, and we don't have to deal with it. But actually, you know, there are ways, one, you know, good ways and bad ways of dealing with it. And that's what we'll be talking about. So thanks again for tuning in today. My guest again has been Christy Robb, the Director of Food Services for St. John's Bread and Life. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and I'll see you next week. Thanks a lot for tuning in. Bye-bye. Disappearing views of someone else's state of grace. Well, I know you're disappointed. I get angry when you move. There's a force that's out of focus, but it all depends on you. I get by. Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.